while I am shut up in here," replied the genius. "Let me out, and I will make you rich."
The hope of being no longer poor made the fisherman give way. "If you will give me your promise to do this, I will open the lid. I do not think you will dare to break your word." The genius promised, and the fisherman lifted the lid. He came out at once in smoke, and then, having resumed his proper form, the first thing he did was to kick the vase into the sea. This frightened the fisherman, but the genius laughed and said,
"Do not be afraid. I only did it to frighten you, and to show you that I intend to keep my word. Take your nets and follow me."
He began to walk in front of the fisherman, who followed him with some misgivings. They passed in front of the town, and went up a mountain, and then down into a great plain, where there was a large lake lying between four hills. When they reached the lake, the genius said to the fisherman,
"Throw your nets and catch fish."
The fisherman did as he was told, hoping for a good catch, as he saw plenty of fish. What was his astonishment at seeing that there were four quite different kinds, some white, some red, some blue, and some yellow. He caught four, one of each color. As he had never seen any like them, he admired them very much, and he was very pleased to think how much money he would get for them.
"Take these fish and carry them to the Sultan, who will give you more money for them than you have ever had in your life. You can come every day to fish in this lake, but be careful not to throw your nets more than once every day. Otherwise, some harm will happen to you. If you follow my advice carefully, you will find it good."
Saying these words, he struck his foot against the ground, which opened, and when he had disappeared, it closed immediately. The fisherman resolved to obey the genius exactly, so he did not cast his nets a second time, but walked into the town to sell his fish at the palace. When the Sultan saw the fish, he was much astonished. He looked at them one after the other, and when he had admired them long enough,
"Take these fish," he said to the first vizier, "and give them to the clever cook the Emperor of the Greeks sent me. I think they must be as good as they are beautiful."
The vizier took them himself to the cook, saying,
"Here are four fish that have been brought to the Sultan. He wants you to cook them."
Then he went back to the Sultan, who told him to give the fisherman 400 gold pieces. The fisherman, who had never before possessed such a large sum of money at once, could hardly believe his good fortune. He at once relieved the needs of his family and made good use of it. But now we must return to the kitchen, which we shall find in great confusion. The cook, when she had cleaned the fish, put them in a pan with some oil to fry them. When she thought them cooked enough on one side, she turned them on the other. But scarcely had she done so when the walls of the kitchen opened, and there came out a young and beautiful damsel. She was dressed in an Egyptian dress of flowered satin, and she wore earrings, and a necklace of white pearls, and bracelets of gold set with rubies, and she held a wand of myrtle in her hand. She went up to the pan, to the great astonishment of the cook, who stood motionless at the sight of her. She struck one of the fish with her rod.
"Fish, fish," said she, "are you doing your duty?"
The fish answered nothing, and then she repeated her question, whereupon they all raised their heads together and answered very distinctly,
"Yes, yes, if you reckon, we reckon. If you pay your debts, we pay ours. If you fly, we conquer, and we are content."
When they had spoken, the girl upset the pan and entered the opening in the wall, which at once closed and appeared the same as before. When the cook had recovered from her fright, she lifted up the fish which had fallen into the ashes, but she found them as black as cinders and not fit to serve up to the Sultan. She began to cry,
"Alas, what shall I say to the Sultan? He will be so angry with me, and I know he will not believe me."
Whilst she was crying, the Grand Vizier came in and asked if the fish were ready. She told him all that had happened, and he was much surprised. He sent at once for the fisherman, and when he came, said to him,
Fishermen, bring me 4 more fish like those you have brought already, for an accident has happened to them, so that they cannot be served up to the Sultan.
The fisherman did not say what the genius had told him, but he excused himself from bringing them that day on account of the length of the way, and he promised to bring them next day. In the night he went to the lake, cast his nets, and on drawing them in found 4 fish, which were like the others, each of a different color. He went back at once and carried them to the Grand Vizier as he had promised. He then took them to the kitchen and shut himself up with the cook, who began to cook them, as she had done the 4 others on the previous day. When she was about to turn them on the other side, the wall opened, the damsel appeared, addressed the same words to the fish, received the same answer, and then overturned the pan, and disappeared. The Grand Vizier was filled with astonishment.
"I shall tell the Sultan all that has happened," said he,
and he did so. The Sultan was very much astounded and wished to see this marvel for himself, so he sent for the fisherman and asked him to procure 4 more fish. The fisherman asked for 3 days, which were granted, and he then cast his nets in the lake and again caught 4 different colored fish. The Sultan was delighted to see he had got them and gave him again 400 gold pieces. As soon as the Sultan had the fish, he had them carried to his room with all that was needed to cook them. Then he shut himself up with the Grand Vizier, who began to prepare them and cook them. When they were done on one side, he turned them over on the other. Then the wall of the room opened, but instead of the maiden, a black slave came out. He was enormously tall and carried a large green stick with which he touched the fish, saying in a terrible voice,
"Fish, fish! Are you doing your duty?"
To these words, the fish, lifting up their heads, replied,
"Yes, yes. If you reckon, we reckon. If you pay your debts, we pay ours. If you fly, we conquer and are content."
The black slave overturned the pan in the middle of the room, and the fish were turned to cinders. Then he stepped proudly back into the wall, which closed round him.
"After having seen this," said the Sultan, "I cannot rest. These fish signify some mystery I must clear up."
He sent for the fisherman.
"Fisherman," he said, "the fish you have brought us have caused me some anxiety. Where did you get them from?"
"Sire," he answered, "I got them from a lake which lies in the middle of 4 hills beyond yonder mountains."
"Do you know this lake?" asked the Sultan of the Grand Vizier.
"No, though I have hunted many times round that mountain. I have never even heard of it," said the vizier.
As the fisherman said it was only 3 hours' journey away, the Sultan ordered his whole court to mount and ride thither, and the fisherman led them. They climbed the mountain, and then, on the other side, saw the lake as the fisherman had described. The water was so clear that they could see the 4 kinds of fish swimming about in it. They looked at them for some time, and then the Sultan ordered them to make a camp by the edge of the water. When night came, the Sultan called his vizier and said to him,
"I have resolved to clear up this mystery. I am going out alone, and do you stay here in my tent, and when my ministers come tomorrow, say I am not well and cannot see them. Do this each day till I return."
The Grand Vizier tried to persuade the Sultan not to go, but in vain. The Sultan took off his state robe and put on his sword, and when he saw all was quiet in the camp, he set forth alone. He climbed one of the hills, and then crossed the great plain, till, just as the sun rose, he beheld far in front of him a large building. When he came near to it, he saw it was a splendid palace of beautiful black polished marble, covered with steel as smooth as a mirror. He went to the gate, which stood half open, and went in, as nobody came when he knocked. He passed through a magnificent courtyard and still saw no one, though he called aloud several times. He entered large halls where the carpets were of silk, the lounges and sofas covered with tapestry from Mecca, and the hangings of the most beautiful Indian stuffs of gold and silver. Then he found himself in a splendid room, with a fountain supported by golden lions. The water out of the lions' mouths turned into diamonds and pearls, and the leaping water almost touched a most beautifully painted dome. The palace was surrounded on three sides by magnificent gardens, little lakes, and woods. Birds sang in the trees, which were netted over to keep them always there. Still the Sultan saw no one, till he heard a plaintive cry, and a voice which said,
"Oh, that I could die, for I am too unhappy to wish to live any longer."
The Sultan looked round to discover who it was who thus bemoaned his fate, and at last saw a handsome young man, richly clothed, who was sitting on a throne raised slightly from the ground. His face was very sad. The Sultan approached him and bowed to him. The young man bent his head very low, but did not rise.
"Sire," he said to the Sultan, "I cannot rise and do you the reverence that I am sure should be paid to your rank."
"Sir," answered the Sultan, "I am sure you have a good reason for not doing so, and having heard your cry of distress, I am come to offer you my help. Whose is this palace, and why is it thus empty?"
Instead of answering, the young man lifted up his robe and showed the Sultan that, from the waist downwards, he was a block of black marble. The Sultan was horrified and begged the young man to tell him his story.
"Willingly, I will tell you my sad history," said the young man.
The Story of the Young King of the Black Isles. You must know, sire, that my father was Mahmud, the king of this country, the Black Isles, so called from the four little mountains which were once islands, while the capital was the place where now the great lake lies. My story will tell you how these changes came about. My father died when he was 66, and I succeeded him. I married my cousin, whom I loved tenderly, and I thought she loved me too. But one afternoon, when I was half asleep and was being fanned by two of her maids, I heard one say to the other,
"What a pity it is that our mistress no longer loves our master. I believe she would like to kill him if she could, for she is an enchantress."
I soon found by watching that they were right, and when I mortally wounded a favorite slave of hers for a great crime, she begged that she might build a palace in the garden where she wept and bewailed him for 2 years. At last I begged her to cease grieving for him, for although he could not speak or move, by her enchantments she kept him alive. She turned upon me in a rage and said over me some magic words, and I instantly became as you see me now, half man and half marble. Then this wicked enchantress changed the capital, which was a very populous and flourishing city, into the lake and desert plain you saw. The fish of four colors which are in it are the different races who lived in the town, the four hills are the four islands which give the name to my kingdom. All this the enchantress told me to add to my troubles. And this is not all. Every day she comes and beats me with a whip of buffalo hide." When the young king had finished his sad story, he burst once more into tears, and the Sultan was much moved.
"Tell me," he cried, "where is this wicked woman, and where is the miserable object of her affection, whom she just manages to keep alive?"
"Where she lives I do not know," answered the unhappy prince, "but she goes every day at sunrise to see if the slave can yet speak to her, after she has beaten me."
"Unfortunate king," said the Sultan, "I will do what I can to avenge you."
So he consulted with the young king over the best way to bring this about, and they agreed their plan should be put in effect the next day. The Sultan then rested, and the young king gave himself up to happy hopes of release. The next day the Sultan arose, and then went to the palace in the garden where the black slave was. He drew his sword and destroyed the little life that remained in him, and then threw the body down a well. He then lay down on the couch where the slave had been, and waited for the enchantress. She went first to the young king, whom she beat with 100 blows. Then she came to the room where she thought her wounded slave was, but where the Sultan really lay. She came near his couch and said,
"Are you better today, my dear slave? Speak but one word to me."
"How can I be better?"
answered the Sultan, imitating the language of the Ethiopians,
when I can never sleep for the cries and groans of your husband.
What a joy to hear you speak, answered the Queen. Do you wish him to regain his proper shape?
Yes, said the Sultan. Hasten to set him at liberty, so that I may no longer hear his cries.
The queen at once went out and took a cup of water and said over it some words that made it boil as if it were on fire. Then she threw it over the prince, who at once regained his own form. He was filled with joy, but the enchantress said,
Hasten away from this palace and never come back, lest I kill you.
So he hid himself to see the end of the sultan's plan. The enchantress went back to the palace of tears and said,
Now I have done what you wished.
What you have done, said the Sultan, is not enough to cure me. Every day at midnight all the people whom you have changed into fish lift their heads out of the lake and cry for vengeance. Go quickly and give them their proper shape.
The enchantress hurried away and said some words over the lake. The fish then became men, women, and children, and the houses and shops were once more filled. The Sultan's suite, who had encamped by the lake, were not a little astonished to see themselves in the middle of a large and beautiful town. As soon as she had disenchanted it, the queen went back to the palace.
Are you quite well now?
She said.
Come near, said the Sultan. Nearer still.
She obeyed. Then he sprang up, and with one blow of his sword, he cut her in two. Then he went and found the prince.
Rejoice, he said. Your cruel enemy is dead.
The prince thanked him again and again.
And now, said the Sultan, I will go back to my capital, which I am glad to find is so near yours.
So near mine? Said the King of the Black Isles. Do you know it is a whole year's journey from here? You came here in a few hours because it was enchanted, but I will accompany you on your journey.
It will give me much pleasure if you will escort me, said the Sultan, and as I have no children, I will make you my heir.
The Sultan and the prince set out together, the Sultan laden with rich presents from the King of the Black Isles. The day after he reached his capital, the Sultan assembled his court and told them all that had befallen him, and told them how he intended to adopt the young king as his heir. Then he gave each man presents in proportion to his rank. As for the fisherman, as he was the first cause of the deliverance of the young prince, the Sultan gave him much money, and made him and his family happy for the rest of their days. The Story of Three Calendars, Sons of Kings, and of Five Ladies of Baghdad. In the reign of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, there lived at Baghdad a porter who, in spite of his humble calling, was an intelligent and sensible man. One morning he was sitting in his usual place with his basket before him, waiting to be hired, when a tall young lady, covered with a long muslin veil, came up to him and said,
Pick up your basket and follow me.
The porter, who was greatly pleased by her appearance and voice, jumped up at once, poised his basket on his head, and accompanied the lady, saying to himself as he went,
Oh, happy day! Oh, lucky meeting!
The lady soon stopped before a closed door, at which she knocked. It was opened by an old man with a long white beard, to whom the lady held out money without speaking. The old man, who seemed to understand what she wanted, vanished into the house, and returned bringing a large jar of wine, which the porter placed in his basket. Then the lady signed to him to follow, and they went their way. The next place she stopped at was a fruit and flower shop, and here she bought a large quantity of apples, apricots, peaches, and other things, with lilies, jasmine, and all sorts of sweet-smelling plants. From this shop she went to a butcher's, a grocer's, and a poulterer's, till at last the porter exclaimed in despair,
My good lady, if you had only told me you were going to buy enough provisions to stock a town, I would have brought a horse, or rather a camel.
The lady laughed and told him she had not finished yet, but after choosing various kinds of scents and spices from a druggist's store, she halted before a magnificent palace, at the door of which she knocked gently. The porteress who opened it was of such beauty that the eyes of the man were quite dazzled, and he was the more astonished as he saw clearly that she was no slave. The lady who had led him hither stood watching with amusement till the porteress exclaimed,
"Why don't you come in, my sister? This poor man is so heavily weighed down that he is ready to drop."
When they were both inside, the door was fastened, and they all three entered a large court, surrounded by an open-work gallery. At one end of the court was a platform, and on the platform stood an amber throne supported by four ebony columns garnished with pearls and diamonds. In the middle of the court stood a marble basin filled with water from the mouth of a golden lion. The porter looked about him, noticing and admiring everything, but his attention was specially attracted by a third lady sitting on the throne, who was even more beautiful than the other two. By the respect shown to her by the others, he judged that she must be the eldest, and in this he was right. This lady's name was Obeida, the porteress was Sadie, and the housekeeper was Amina. At a word from Zobeida, Sadie and Amina took the basket from the porter, who was glad enough to be relieved from its weight, and when it was emptied, paid him handsomely for its use. But instead of taking up his basket and going away, the man still lingered, till Zobeida inquired what he was waiting for, and if he expected more money.
"Oh, madam," returned he, "you have already given me too much, and I fear I may have been guilty of rudeness in not taking my departure at once. But, if you will pardon my saying so, I was lost in astonishment at seeing such beautiful ladies by themselves. A company of women without men is, however, as dull as a company of men without women."
And after telling some stories to prove his point, he ended by entreating them to let him stay and make a fourth at their dinner. The ladies were rather amused at the man's assurance, and after some discussion it was agreed that he should be allowed to stay, as his society might prove entertaining.
"But listen, friend," said Zobeida. "If we grant your request, it is only on condition that you behave with the utmost politeness, and that you keep the secret of our way of living, which chance has revealed to you."
Then they all sat down to table, which had been covered by Amina with the dishes she had bought. After the first few mouthfuls, Amina poured some wine into a golden cup. She first drank herself, according to the Arab custom, and then filled it for her sisters. When it came to the porter's turn, he kissed Amina's hand and sang a song, which he composed at the moment in praise of the wine. The three ladies were pleased with the song, and then sang themselves, so that the repast was a merry one, and lasted much longer than usual. At length, seeing that the sun was about to set, Sadie said to the porter,
"Rise and go. It is now time for us to separate."
"Oh, madam," replied he, "how can you desire me to quit you in the state in which I am? Between the wine I have drunk and the pleasure of seeing you, I should never find the way to my house. Let me remain here till morning, and when I have recovered my senses, I will go when you like."
"Let him stay,"
said Amina, who had before proved herself his friend.
"It is only just, as he has given us so much amusement." "If you wish, my sister," replied Zobeida, "but if he does, I must make a new condition. Porter," she continued, turning to him, "if you remain, you must promise to ask no questions about anything you may see. If you do, you may perhaps hear what you don't like."
This being settled, Amina brought in supper and lit up the hall with a number of sweet-smelling tapers. They then sat down again at the table and began with fresh appetites to eat, drink, sing, and recite verses. In fact, they were all enjoying themselves mightily when they heard a knock at the outer door, which Sadie rose to open. She soon returned saying that three calenders, all blind in the right eye, and all with their heads, faces, and eyebrows clean-shaved, begged for admittance, as they were newly arrived in Baghdad, and night had already fallen.
"They seem to have pleasant manners," she added, "but you have no idea how funny they look. I'm sure we should find their company diverting."
Zobeida and Amina made some difficulty about admitting the newcomers, and Sadie knew the reason of their hesitation, but she urged the matter so strongly that Zobeida was at last forced to consent.
"Bring them in, then," said she, "but make them understand that they are not to make remarks about what does not concern them, and be sure to make them read the inscription over the door."
For on the door was written in letters of gold, "Whoso meddles in affairs that are no business of his will hear truths that will not please him." The three Calenders bowed low on entering and thanked the ladies for their kindness and hospitality. The ladies replied with words of welcome, and they were all about to seat themselves when the eyes of the Calenders fell on the porter, whose dress was not so very unlike their own, though he still wore all the hair that nature had given him.
"This," said one of them, "is apparently one of our Arab brothers who has rebelled against our rules."
The porter, although half asleep from the wine he had drunk, heard the words, and without moving cried angrily to the Calender,
"Sit down and mind your own business. Did you not read the inscription over the door? Everybody is not obliged to live in the same way."
"Do not be so angry, my good man," replied the Calender. "We should be very sorry to displease you."
So the quarrel was smoothed over, and supper began in good earnest. When the Calenders had satisfied their hunger, they offered to play to their hostesses, if there were any instruments in the house. The ladies were delighted at the idea, and Sadie went to see what she could find, returning in a few moments laden with two different kinds of flutes and a tambourine. Each Calender took the one he preferred, and began to play a well-known air, while the ladies sang the words of the song. These words were the gayest and liveliest possible, and every now and then the singers had to stop to indulge the laughter which almost choked them. In the midst of all their noise, a knock was heard at the door. Now early that evening the caliph secretly left the palace, accompanied by his grand vizier, Jafar, and Mesrur, chief of the eunuchs, all three wearing the dresses of merchants. Passing down the street, the caliph had been attracted by the music of instruments and the sound of laughter, and had ordered his vizier to go and knock at the door of the house, as he wished to enter. The vizier replied that the ladies who lived there seemed to be entertaining their friends, and he thought his master would do well not to intrude on them, but the caliph had taken it into his head to see for himself, and insisted on being obeyed. The knock was answered by Sadie, with a taper in her hand, and the vizier, who was surprised at her beauty, bowed low before her, and said respectfully,
"Madam, we are three merchants who have lately arrived from Mosul, and, owing to a misadventure which befell us this very night, only reached our inn to find that the doors were closed to us till tomorrow morning. Not knowing what to do, we wandered in the streets till we happened to pass your house, when, seeing lights and hearing the sound of voices, we resolved to ask you to give us shelter till the dawn. If you will grant us this favor, we will, with your permission, do all in our power to help you spend the time pleasantly."
Sadie answered the merchant that she must first consult her sisters, and after having talked over the matter with them, she returned to tell him that he and his two friends would be welcome to join their company. They entered and bowed politely to the ladies and their guests. Then Zobeida, as the mistress, came forward and said gravely,
"You are welcome here, but I hope you will allow me to beg one thing of you. Have as many eyes as you like, but no tongues, and ask no questions about anything you see, however strange it may appear to you."
"Madam," returned the vizier, "you shall be obeyed. We have quite enough to please and interest us, without troubling ourselves about that with which we have no concern."
Then they all sat down and drank to the health of the newcomers. While the vizier, Jafar, was talking to the ladies, the caliph was occupied in wondering who they could be, and why the three Calenders had each lost his right eye. He was burning to inquire the reason of it all, but was silenced by Zobeida's request, so he tried to rouse himself and to take his part in the conversation, which was very lively, the subject of discussion being the many different sorts of pleasures that there were in the world. After some time, the calenders got up and performed some curious dances which delighted the rest of the company. When they had finished, Zobeida rose from her seat, and, taking Amina by the hand, she said to her,
"My sister, our friends will excuse us if we seem to forget their presence and fulfill our nightly task."
Amina understood her sister's meaning, and collecting the dishes, glasses, and musical instruments, she carried them away, while Sadie swept the hall and put everything in order. Having done this, she begged the calenders to sit on a sofa on one side of the room, and the caliph and his friends to place themselves opposite. As to the porter, she requested him to come and help her and her sister. Shortly after, Amina entered carrying a seat, which she put down in the middle of the empty space. She next went over to the door of a closet, and signed to the porter to follow her. He did so, and soon reappeared leading two black dogs by a chain, which he brought into the center of the hall. Zobeida then got up from her seat between the calenders and the caliph, and walked slowly across to where the porter stood with the dogs.
"We must do our duty,"
she said with a deep sigh. Pushing back her sleeves, and taking a whip from Sadie, she said to the man,
"Take one of those dogs to my sister Amina, and give me the other."
The porter did as he was bid, but as he led the dog to Zobeida, it uttered piercing howls, and gazed up at her with looks of entreaty. But Zobeida took no notice, and whipped the dog till she was out of breath. She then took the chain from the porter, and, raising the dog on its hind legs, they looked into each other's eyes sorrowfully, till tears began to fall from both. Then Zobeida took her handkerchief and wiped the dog's eyes tenderly, after which she kissed it. Then, putting the chain into the porter's hand, she said,
"Take it back to the closet, and bring me the other."
The same ceremony was gone through with the second dog, and all the while the whole company looked on with astonishment. The caliph in particular could hardly contain himself, and made signs to the vizier to ask what it all meant, but the vizier pretended not to see and turned his head away. Zobeida remained for some time in the middle of the room, till at last Sadie went up to her and begged her to sit down, as she also had her part to play. At these words, Amina fetched a lute from a case of yellow satin, and gave it to Sadie, who sang several songs to its accompaniment. When she was tired, she said to Amina,
"My sister, I can do no more. Come, I pray you, and take my place."
Amina struck a few chords and then broke into a song, which she sang with so much ardor that she was quite overcome, and sank gasping on a pile of cushions, tearing open her dress as she did so to give herself some air. To the amazement of all present, her neck, instead of being as smooth and white as her face, was a mass of scars. The calenders and the caliph looked at each other and whispered together, unheard by Zobeida and Sadie, who were tending their fainting sister.
"What does it all mean?"
asked the caliph.
"We know no more than you,"
said the calender to whom he had spoken.
"What? You do not belong to the house?"
"My lord,"
answered all the calenders together,
"we came here for the first time, an hour before you."
Then they turned to the porter to see if he could explain the mystery, but the porter was no wiser than they were themselves. At length the caliph could contain his curiosity no longer, and declared that he would compel the ladies to tell them the meaning of their strange conduct. The vizier, foreseeing what would happen, implored him to remember the condition their hostesses had imposed, and added in a whisper that if his highness would only wait till morning, he could, as caliph, summon the ladies to appear before him. But the caliph, who was not accustomed to being contradicted, rejected this advice, and it was resolved after a little more talking that the question should be put by the porter. Suddenly Zobeida turned around, and seeing their excitement, she said,
"What is the matter, What are you all discussing so earnestly?
Madam, answered the porter, these gentlemen entreat you to explain to them why you should first whip the dogs, and then cry over them, and also how it happens that the fainting lady is covered with scars. They have requested me, madam, to be their mouthpiece.
Is it true, gentlemen?
Asked Zobeida, drawing herself up.
That you have charged this man to put me that question?
It is, they all replied, except Jafar, who was silent.
Is this,
continued Zobeida, growing more angry every moment,
is this the return you make for the hospitality I have shown you? Have you forgotten the one condition on which you were allowed to enter the house? Come quickly, she added, clapping her hands three times,
and the words were hardly uttered when seven black slaves, each armed with a saber, burst in and stood over the seven men, throwing them on the ground and preparing themselves, on a sign from their mistress, to cut off their heads. The seven culprits all thought their last hour had come, and the caliph repented bitterly that he had not taken the vizier's advice. But they made up their minds to die bravely, all except the porter, who loudly inquired of Zobeida why he was to suffer for other people's faults, and declared that these misfortunes would never have happened if it had not been for the calendars, who always brought ill luck. He ended up imploring Zobeida not to confound the innocent with the guilty and to spare his life. In spite of her anger, there was something so comic in the groans of the porter that Zobeida could not refrain from laughing. But putting him aside, she addressed the others a second time, saying,
"Answer me. Who are you? Unless you tell me truly, you have not another moment to live. I can hardly think you are men of any position, whatever country you belong to. If you were, you would have had more consideration for us."
The caliph, who was naturally very impatient, suffered far more than either of the others at feeling that his life was at the mercy of a justly offended lady, but when he heard her question, he began to breathe more freely, for he was convinced that she had only to learn his name and rank for all danger to be over. So he whispered hastily to the vizier, who was next to him, to reveal their secret. But the vizier, wiser than his master, wished to conceal from the public the affront they had received, and merely answered,
"After all, we have only got what we deserved."
Meanwhile, Zobeida had turned to the three calendars and inquired if, as they were all blind, they were brothers.
"No, madam," replied one. "We are no blood relations at all, only brothers by our mode of life." "And you," she asked, addressing another, "were you born blind of one eye?"
"No, madam," returned he. "I became blind through a most surprising adventure, such as probably has never happened to anybody. After that, I shaved my head and eyebrows and put on the dress in which you see me now."
Zobeida put the same question to the other two calendars and received the same answer.
"But," added the third, "it may interest you, madam, to know that we are not men of low birth, but are all three sons of kings, and of kings, too, whom the world holds in high esteem."
At these words, Zobeida's anger cooled, and she turned to her slaves and said,
"You can give them a little more liberty, but do not leave the hall. Those that will tell us their histories and their reasons for coming here shall be allowed to leave unhurt. Those who refuse..."
And she paused, but in a moment the porter, who understood that he had only to relate his story to set himself free from this terrible danger, immediately broke in,
"Madam, you know already how I came here, and what I have to say will soon be told. Your sister found me this morning in the place where I always stand, waiting to be hired. She bade me follow her to various shops, and when my basket was quite full, we returned to this house, when you had the goodness to permit me to remain, for which I shall be eternally grateful. That is my story."
He looked anxiously to Zobeida, who nodded her head and said,
"You can go, and take care we never meet again."
"Oh, madam," cried the porter, "let me stay yet a little while. It is not just that the others should have heard my story, and that I should not hear theirs."
And without waiting for permission, he seated himself on the end of the sofa occupied by the ladies, whilst the rest crouched on the carpet and the slaves stood against the wall. Then one of the calenders, addressing himself to Zobeda as the principal lady, began his story. The Story of the First Calender, Son of a King.
In order, madam, to explain how I came to lose my right eye, and to wear the dress of a calender, you must first know that I am the son of a king. My father's only brother reigned over the neighboring country, and had two children, a daughter and a son, who were of the same age as myself. As I grew up, and was allowed more liberty, I went every year to pay a visit to my uncle's court, and usually stayed there about 2 months. In this way, my cousin and I became very intimate, and were much attached to each other. The very last time I saw him, he seemed more delighted to see me than ever, and gave a great feast in my honor. When we had finished eating, he said to me,
"My cousin, you would never guess what I have been doing since your last visit to us. Directly after your departure, I set a number of men to work on a building after my own design. It is now completed and ready to be lived in. I should like to show it to you, but you must first swear two things: to be faithful to me, and to keep my secret." Of course, I did not dream of refusing him anything he asked, and gave the promise without the least hesitation. He then bade me to wait an instant, and vanished, returning in a few moments with a richly dressed lady of great beauty. But as he did not tell me her name, I thought it was better not to inquire. We all three sat down to table, and amused ourselves with talking of all sorts of indifferent things, and with drinking each other's health. Suddenly the prince said to me, "Cousin, we have no time to lose. Be so kind as to conduct this lady to a certain spot, where you will find a dome-like tomb, newly built. You cannot mistake it. Go in, both of you, and wait till I come. I shall not be long."
As I had promised, I prepared to do as I was told, and giving my hand to the lady, I escorted her, by the light of the moon, to the place of which the prince had spoken. We had barely reached it, when he joined us himself, carrying a small vessel of water, a pickaxe, and a little bag containing plaster. With the pickaxe, he at once began to destroy the empty sepulchre in the middle of the tomb. One by one he took the stones and piled them up in a corner. When he had knocked down the whole sepulchre, he proceeded to dig at the earth, and beneath where the sepulchre had been, I saw a trap door. He raised the door, and I caught sight of the top of a spiral staircase. Then he said, turning to the lady,
"Madam, this is the way that will lead you down to the spot which I told you of."
The lady did not answer, but silently descended the staircase, the prince following her. At the top, however, he looked at me.
"My cousin,"
he exclaimed,
"I do not know how to thank you for your kindness. Farewell."
"What do you mean?" I cried. "I don't understand."
"No matter," he replied. "Go back by the path that you came."
He would say no more, and greatly puzzled, I returned to my room in the palace and went to bed. When I woke and considered my adventure, I thought that I must have been dreaming, and sent a servant to ask if the prince was dressed and could see me. But on hearing that he had not slept at home, I was much alarmed, and hastened to the cemetery, where unluckily the tombs were all so alike that I could not discover which was the one I was in search of, though I spent 4 days in looking for it.
You must know that all this time the king, my uncle, was absent on a hunting expedition, and as no one knew when he would be back, I at last decided to return home, leaving the ministers to make my excuses. I longed to tell them what had become of the prince, about whose fate they felt the most dreadful anxiety, but the oath I had sworn kept me silent. On my arrival at my father's capital, I was astonished to find a large detachment of guards drawn up before the gate of the palace. They surrounded me directly I entered.
I asked the officers in command the reason of this strange behavior, and was horrified to learn that the army had mutinied and put to death the king, my father, and had placed the Grand Vizier on the throne. Further, that by his orders, I was placed under arrest. Now this rebel vizier had hated me from my boyhood, because once, when shooting at a bird with a bow, I had shot out his eye by accident. Of course, I not only sent a servant at once to offer him my regrets and apologies, but I made them in person. It was all of no use. He cherished an undying hatred towards me, and lost no occasion of showing it. Having once got me in his power, I felt he could show no mercy, and I was right. Mad with triumph and fury, he came to me in my prison and tore out my right eye. That is how I lost it. My persecutor, however, did not stop here. He shut me up in a large case and ordered his executioner to carry me into a desert place, to cut off my head, and then to abandon my body to the birds of prey. The case, with me inside it, was accordingly placed on a horse, and the executioner, accompanied by another man, rode into the country until they found a spot suitable for the purpose. But their hearts were not so hard as they seemed, and my tears and prayers made them waver.
"Forsake the kingdom instantly," said the executioner at last, "and take care never to come back, for you will not only lose your head, but make us lose ours."
I thanked him gratefully, and tried to console myself for the loss of my eye, by thinking of the other misfortunes I had escaped. After all I had gone through, and my fear of being recognized by some enemy, I could only travel very slowly and cautiously, generally resting in some out-of-the-way place by day, and walking as far as I was able by night. But at length I arrived in the kingdom of my uncle, of whose protection I was sure. I found him in great trouble about the disappearance of his son, who had, he said, vanished without leaving a trace. But his own grief did not prevent him sharing mine. We mingled our tears, for the loss of one was the loss of the other, and then I made up my mind that it was my duty to break the solemn oath I had sworn to the prince. I therefore lost no time in telling my uncle everything I knew, and I observed that even before I had ended, his sorrow appeared to be lightened a little.
"My dear nephew," he said, "your story gives me some hope. I was aware that my son was building a tomb, and I think I can find the spot. But as he wished to keep the matter secret, let us go alone and seek the place ourselves."
He then bade me disguise myself, and we both slipped out of a garden door which opened onto the cemetery. It did not take long for us to arrive at the scene of the prince's disappearance, or to discover the tomb I had sought so vainly before. We entered it, and found the trap door which led to the staircase, but we had great difficulty in raising it, because the prince had fastened it down underneath with the plaster he had brought with him. My uncle went first, and I followed him. When we reached the bottom of the stairs, we stepped into a sort of anteroom, filled with such a dense smoke that it was hardly possible to see anything. However, we passed through the smoke into a large chamber, which at first seemed quite empty. The room was brilliantly lighted, and in another moment we perceived a sort of platform at one end, on which were the bodies of the prince and a lady, both half-burned, as if they had been dragged out of a fire before it had quite consumed them. This horrible sight turned me faint, but, to my surprise, my uncle did not show so much surprise as anger.
"I knew," he said, "that my son was tenderly attached to this lady whom it was impossible he should ever marry. I tried to turn his thoughts and presented to him the most beautiful princesses, but he cared for none of them, and, as you see, they have now been united by a horrible death in an underground tomb."
But, as he spoke, his anger melted into tears, and again I wept with him. When he recovered himself, he drew me to him.
"My dear nephew,"
he said, embracing me,
"you have come to me to take his place, and I will do my best to forget that I ever had a son who could act in so wicked a manner."
Then he turned,
and went up the stairs. We reached the palace without anyone having noticed our absence, when, shortly after, a clashing of drums and cymbals and the blare of trumpets burst upon our astonished ears. At the same time, a thick cloud of dust on the horizon told of the approach of a great army. My heart sank when I perceived that the commander was the vizier, who had dethroned my father, and was come to seize the kingdom of my uncle. The capital was utterly unprepared to stand a siege, and seeing that resistance was useless, at once opened its gates. My uncle fought hard for his life, but was soon overpowered, and when he fell, I managed to escape through a secret passage and took refuge with an officer whom I knew I could trust. Persecuted by ill fortune, and stricken with grief, there seemed to be only one means of safety left to me. I shaved my beard and my eyebrows, and put on the dress of a calender, in which it was easy for me to travel without being known. I avoided the towns till I reached the kingdom of the famous and powerful caliph, Harun al-Rashid, when I had no further reason to fear my enemies. It was my intention to come to Baghdad, and to throw myself at the feet of His Highness, who would, I felt certain, be touched by my sad story, and would grant me, besides, his help and protection. After a journey which lasted some months, I arrived at length at the gates of this city. It was sunset, and I paused for a little to look about me, and to decide which way to turn my steps. I was still debating on this subject when I was joined by this other calender, who stopped to greet me. "You, like me, appear to be a stranger," I said. He replied that I was right, and before he could say more, the third calender came up. He also was newly arrived in Baghdad, and being brothers in misfortune, we resolved to cast in our lots together, and to share whatever fate might have in store. By this time it had grown late, and we did not know where to spend the night. By our lucky star, having guided us to this door, we took the liberty of knocking and of asking for shelter, which was given to us at once with the best grace in the world. This, madam, is my story.
"I am satisfied," replied Zobeida. "You can go when you like."
The calender, however, begged leave to stay and to hear the histories of his two friends and of the three other persons of the company, which he was allowed to do. The Story of the Second Calender, Son of a King.
"Madam," said the young man, addressing Zobeida, "if you wish to know how I lost my right eye, I shall have to tell you the story of my whole life. I was scarcely more than a baby when the king my father, finding me unusually quick and clever for my age, turned his thoughts to my education. I was taught first to read and write, and then to learn the Quran, which is the basis of our holy religion. And the better to understand it, I read with my tutors the ablest commentators on its teaching, and committed to memory all the traditions respecting the Prophet, which have been gathered from the mouth of those who were his friends. I also learned history, and was instructed in poetry, versification, geography, chronology, and in all the outdoor exercises in which every prince should excel. But what I liked best of all was writing Arabic characters, and in this I soon surpassed my masters, and gained a reputation in this branch of knowledge that reached as far as India itself. Now the Sultan of the Indies, curious to see a young prince with such strange tastes, sent an ambassador to my father, laden with rich presents and a warm invitation to visit his court. My father, who was deeply anxious to secure the friendship of so powerful a monarch, and held besides that a little travel would greatly improve my manners and open my mind, accepted gladly, and in a short time I had set out for India with the ambassador, attended only by a small suite on account of the length of the journey and the badness of the roads. However, as was my duty, I took with me 10 camels laden with rich presents for the Sultan. We had been traveling for about a month when one day
we saw a cloud of dust moving swiftly towards us. And as soon as it came near, we found that the dust concealed a band of 50 robbers. Our men barely numbered half, and as we were also hampered by the camels, there was no use in fighting, so we tried to overawe them by informing them who we were and whither we were going. The robbers, however, only laughed and declared that was none of their business, and, without more words, attacked us brutally. I defended myself to the last, wounded though I was, but at length, seeing that resistance was hopeless, and that the ambassador and all our followers were made prisoners, I put spurs to my horse and rode away as fast as I could, till the poor beast fell dead from a wound in his side. I managed to jump off without any injury, and looked about to see if I was pursued. But for the moment I was safe, for, as I imagined, the robbers were all engaged in quarreling over their booty. I found myself in a country that was quite new to me, and dared not return to the main road, lest I should again fall into the hands of the robbers. Luckily my wound was only a slight one, and after binding it up as well as I could, I walked on for the rest of the day, till I reached a cave at the foot of a mountain, where I passed the night in peace, making my supper off some fruits I had gathered on the way. I wandered about for a whole month, without knowing where I was going, till at length I found myself on the outskirts of a beautiful city, watered by winding streams which enjoyed an eternal spring. My delight at the prospect of mixing once more with human beings was somewhat damped at the thought of the miserable object I must seem. My face and hands had been burned nearly black, my clothes were all in rags, and my shoes were in such a state that I had been forced to abandon them altogether. I entered the town and stopped at a tailor's shop to inquire where I was. The man saw I was better than my condition and begged me to sit down, and in return I told him my whole story. The tailor listened with attention, but his reply, instead of giving me consolation, only increased my trouble.
"Beware," he said, "of telling anyone what you have told me, for the prince who governs the kingdom is your father's greatest enemy, and he will be rejoiced to find you in his power."
I thanked the tailor for his counsel, and said I would do whatever he advised. Then, being very hungry, I gladly ate of the food he put before me, and accepted his offer of a lodging in his house. In a few days, I had quite recovered from the hardships I had undergone, and then the tailor, knowing that it was the custom for the princes of our religion to learn a trade or profession, so as to provide for themselves in times of ill fortune, inquired if there was anything I could do for my living. I replied that I had been educated as a grammarian and a poet, but that my great gift was writing.
"All that is of no use here," said the tailor. "Take my advice, put on a short coat, and as you seem hardy and strong, go into the woods and cut firewood, which you will sell in the streets. By this means you will earn your living, and be able to wait till better times come. The hatchet and the cord shall be my present."
This counsel was very distasteful to me, but I thought I could not do otherwise than adopt it. So the next morning I set out with a company of poor woodcutters, to whom the tailor had introduced me. Even on the first day I cut enough wood to sell for a tolerable sum, and very soon I became more expert, and had made enough money to repay the tailor all he had lent me. I had been a woodcutter for more than a year, when one day I wandered further into the forest than I had ever done before, and reached a delicious green glade, where I began to cut wood. I was hacking at the root of a tree, when I beheld an iron ring fastened to a trap door of the same metal. I soon cleared away the earth, and pulled up the door, found a staircase, which I hastily made up my mind to go down, carrying my hatchet with me by way of protection. When I reached the bottom, I discovered that I was in a huge palace, as brilliantly lighted as any palace above ground that I had ever seen, with a long gallery
supported by pillars of jasper, ornamented with capitals of gold. Down this gallery, a lady came to meet me, of such beauty that I forgot everything else, and thought only of her. To save her all the trouble possible, I hastened towards her and bowed low.
"Who are you? Who are you?"
she said.
"A man or a genius?"
"A man, madam," I replied. "I have nothing to do with genii."
"By what accident do you come here?"
she asked again, with a sigh.
"I have been in this place now for 25 years, and you are the first man who has visited me."
Emboldened by her beauty and gentleness, I ventured to reply, "Before, madam, I answer your question, allow me to say how grateful I am for this meeting, which is not only a consolation to me in my own heavy sorrow, but may perhaps enable me to render your lot happier." And then I told her who I was, and how I had come there.
"Alas, prince,"
she said, with a deeper sigh than before,
"you have guessed rightly in supposing me an unwilling prisoner in this gorgeous place. I am the daughter of the king of the Ebony Isle, of whose fame you surely must have heard. At my father's desire, I was married to a prince who was my own cousin, but on my very wedding day, I was snatched up by a genius and brought here in a faint. For a long while, I did nothing but weep, and would not suffer the genius to come near me, but time teaches us submission, and I have now got accustomed to his presence, and if clothes and jewels could content me, I have them in plenty. Every 10th day, for 25 years, I have received a visit from him, but in case I should need his help at any other time, I have only to touch a talisman that stands at the entrance of my chamber. It wants still 5 days to his next visit, and I hope that during that time, you will do me the honor to be my guest."